regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be talking about an issue that is popping up in a number of states this legislative session, red flag laws, the extreme risk protection, or what they're typically called. Some states call them something else, but this is the scheme by which someone's firearms can be taken away from them temporarily, although these orders can be renewed indefinitely, so they can result in essentially a permanent loss of your ability to own a firearm. If a judge deems you to be a danger to yourself or others. Now, typically, again, these red flag laws have no mental health component. So a judge says, well, we think you're a dangerous person. They take away your ability to legally possess a firearm, and then they consider the problem to be solved, which is one of the reasons why I object to red flag laws. I don't think that they make sense, quite frankly. I think many of these laws do lack due process. In most cases, these are civil proceedings. You are not entitled to a public defender if you can't afford an attorney, although you may be going up against a seasoned prosecutor when you have your day in court. And it might take a while for you to get that day in court because virtually all of these red flag laws have the ability for ex parte hearings. So if, say, petitioner says, hey, this person's really a danger to themselves or others, there's no time to wait. A hearing is held without the subject of the petition being able to attend, provide a defense, or even, frankly, being informed that the hearing is taking place at all. And then typically what happens in those cases is a couple of weeks later, you get your opportunity to show up in court and to try to prove that you are not a danger to yourself or others. One of the issues with red flag laws is that and again, this is just one of the issues, is that it's very difficult to learn about the number of red flag laws or number of red flag petitions that have been filed, the outcome of those petitions, the circumstances surrounding the filing of those petitions. And there's really no measurable way to declare the law a success or not other than the number of red flag petitions that were filed, right? Nobody's really keeping track of, well, how many people went on to take their own lives after a red flag petition was granted? How many people went on to harm others or commit a violent crime or legally acquire a firearm? That information is, I would say it's not necessarily difficult to come by, but it's difficult to collate that information and then apply it to the red flag petitions. Typically what we get from states that even bother to produce any sort of report, a number of red flag petitions that are initiated, the number of red flag petitions that are granted, the number that are rejected, and that's typically it, right? But in Michigan, even that information apparently is now going to be limited. And if you want to drill down on an even more granular level, good luck with that. As the Detroit News reports, detailed data on Michigan's red flag laws, gun seizure cases, gets sparse. They say that the Michigan State Police last week denied a public records request from the Detroit News, seeking a detailed anonymized database of the orders and the circumstances leading to their issuance. State Police provided the 2024 data to the news last year, but denied the new request for the 2025 information because of a change that requires court systems to report their cases directly into the law enforcement information network, which is inaccessible to the public. So in other words, what were public records is now off limits to the public. So again, you weren't going to be able to request this data and find out, I heard that, John Doe got red flagged last year. I want to find out why. You can't get that information, but you can get that anonymized data. 80% of these cases were related to potential suicides. 12% were related to, you know, domestic violence. I'm making these figures up, but now you won't even have access to that information. And both supporters and opponents of red flag laws in Michigan are not happy about this. The Detroit News says a new state-funded group meant to implement the law, faced with the same lack of centralized data, has been collecting case files from each of the state's 83 counties, but some circuit courts have not been cooperative with the request, and the process, even if all courts were responding, is burdensome. The Michigan Firearm Law Implementation Program, funded through the 2024 budget, has yet to receive all of the case files from the 2024 ERPOs, let alone from 2025, said April Zioli, director for the program. Just a note, by the way, that April Zioli is a professor at the University of Michigan, very pro-gun control, and now she's leading this effort to, again, implement the state's red flag law. This is just another example of states using public funds to prop up pro-gun control activists. At the University of Minnesota Law School, you've got Megan Walsh, who is leading a law clinic that works with the anti-gun attorney general on all kinds of gun control cases. Here you've got a public health researcher at the University of Michigan who is helping to implement this red flag law. Anyway, she says that, quote, right now, we don't know what any of these extremist protection orders that were granted are for. And knowing what they're for helps us figure out what problems, what challenges people are facing that law enforcement or family members or healthcare providers are going to ERPO as a solution for. Okay. I guess that is important for the advocates of red flag laws. Although, to me, it seems like they're more interested in just knowing that the numbers of petitions that are granted are going up. The Detroit News says that public records requests to police departments are taking months to process. A complete survey of case files in Michigan courts is not feasible, said Tom Lambert, legislative director for Michigan Open Carry, and an attorney working on some cases for individuals who have had their firearms seized. And Lambert says, regardless of anyone's stance on whether this process should be in place, we should know how it works. We should see, is this working? Is it not working? Are there problems that need to be fixed? And again, without access to even anonymized data of this sort, it's difficult, if not impossible, to know whether or not that's the case. The Detroit News says that the state police provided an anonymized database showing the type of petitioner, whether law enforcement, family member, whatever, a brief summary of the events prompting the request, and the status of the order. That information, which Michigan State Police argues is shielded in the Law Enforcement Information Network system this year, provided data showing that ERPOs have been issued on several minors, including a 6-year-old, and that the Detroit Police Department had issued ERPOs on 4 of its own officers. This year, the Detroit News writes, with more than 500 extreme risk protection orders requested, there is no easy way to get a comprehensive view of why those orders were requested. Last year, when the news requested the 2024 data, the information was still being transferred into that system by state police, and that was considered a public record, said State Police First Lieutenant Mike Shaw. But that changed 4 months after the news reported on the database. Shaw said on June 23, 2025, local courts began putting the information directly into LEIN, and it was no longer kept outside of LEIN. So now, again, this is not a public record. Now, the change apparently was made through legislators. And through legislative action, Mallory McMorrow, who is a Democrat, one of three Democrats, I believe, running for the U.S. Senate this year, was responsible for that change, or at least was the lawmaker behind that change, according to the Detroit News. And she's not too worried about it. According to the Detroit News, she, quote, expressed confidence that the law was working. When the news asked her about the lack of detailed centralized data on cases, she says reporting this program needs to be just as strong. SCAO publishes yearly reports, and I trust every agency involved in implementation will work to do the same. The State Court Administrative Office is the agency that McMorrow was talking about, and they do produce an annual report. But again, it is essentially top-line numbers only, right? The number of requests and orders, how many were granted, how many were denied, How many are active? But as the Detroit News says, even that report lacks detail on what prompted the confiscation or statistics on whether the request came from law enforcement, if him a member or a medical professional. And again, McMorrow doesn't seem to be too worried about that, right? Let's just trust in the process. Well, why should we? I mean, why should we? I think it was the Coalition for Responsible Gun, Michigan Coalition for Responsible Gun Owners, it might have been Michigan Carry, noted that in something like 87 or 89% of these cases, no criminal charges were ever filed. So the individual who was red flagged apparently didn't go on to commit any sort of crime or had not committed a crime beforehand, right? And that's pretty important. But again, we should also, and I think it should go even further than what the information that was provided to the by the Michigan State Police last year actually dealt with. We should know the outcomes of these cases. Did this individual go on to harm themselves or others? Has this individual been arrested for any kind of violent crime, or even a possessory gun offense, for violating the red flag law or the red flag order? How often does that happen? Again, that information is not provided. We know from pro-red flag researchers, they say that for every, I think it's 13 to 20 extreme risk protection orders that are issued, one suicide is prevented. One. So, I mean, at best, you're looking at a 5 to 7% success rate in using red flag laws to prevent suicide. What happens in those other cases? How many of those other cases did the person go on to take their own life? Because the issue wasn't, well, they had access to a firearm. The issue was, well, they were depressed. They were suicidal. And we took their guns, but we didn't provide them any sort of, help with the underlying cause of why they were a danger to themselves. How many individuals never posed a risk to themselves or others at all? It seems ridiculous to argue that the courts are getting this right 100% of the time. That there's no margin of error here, right? Particularly when you look at the number of ex parte or emergency orders that are granted versus the number of final orders that are granted. I was looking at the data for Colorado a couple of weeks ago, and it's pretty staggering. I mean, it was something like 90%+ of the emergency orders were approved. But when it came time for a final approval, only about half of these cases were approved. Which leads me to believe that, judges are playing it safe, right? Somebody comes to you and they say, hey, listen, I'm really worried about, and it doesn't have to be a family member, it could be law enforcement. But we're really worried about this particular individual. We got to act now. Okay. Judge says, okay. What judge wants to say no? And then something bad happens, right? So better safe than sorry. Which may make sense unless you're the gun owner who is not really a danger to themselves or others, who is red flagged because a judge thought better safe than sorry. And then again, when you have an opportunity to present your side of the story, the judge says, oh, okay, well, yeah, I don't really think that you're dangerous. And the final order is denied. There are, again, all kinds of issues that can be identified here with the release of this kind of data. And there's all kinds of reasons why supporters of red flag laws would like to keep this data hidden, because they don't want us to be able to drill down. They don't want us to be able to take a really close look at the circumstances surrounding the issuance of these orders. They don't want us to be able to provide evidence that, yes, judges are rubber stamping these orders in many cases. What they want, again, are more of these orders issued year after year after year. And again, Colorado's a perfect example of this. When Colorado's red flag law took effect, originally, law enforcement family members were the individuals that could file for an extreme risk protection order. But not many orders were filed. And so Democrats in Denver said, okay, well, we're going to expand this. And now, you know, mental health professionals, educators, dating partners will expand the universe of people who can apply for these orders. And the numbers went up, but apparently the numbers didn't go up enough. Because this year, Democrats in Colorado are once again trying to expand the reporting, I guess, right? Who can request an extreme risk protection order? And now what they want to do is allow institutions to file these petitions. So in the past, let's say, you know, a professor or a you know, student's math teacher was concerned about the behavior of that individual, concerned about their access to a firearm. So they'd file a red flag petition. But maybe they were also concerned about retribution, right? And that is that's what this is being billed as a way to protect the privacy of the petitioner. The problem with that, constitutionally, you do have the right, at least in criminal trials, to know your accuser. But again, these are civil cases, right? So maybe that doesn't apply. But the other problem is that in Colorado law, there is a penalty for knowingly filing a false report. Well, if an individual can be charged, what happens when it's an institution that is making the petition? Somebody has to initiate that, right? So does it fall to the individual representing the institution? Like, are they the ones that can be charged? Because you can't charge everybody that works for an institution with knowingly filing a false report, because not everybody knowingly did that, right? But it removes what little accountability there is. And I've asked lawmakers who support this bill, I've asked folks who oppose this bill, how does this work with the provision that exists in state law that says if you file a false report or a report containing false information, you can be prosecuted? How does that work when it comes to institutions? Nobody's been able to give me an answer. So my guess is nobody knows how that actually is going to play out if that expansion gets signed by Governor Jared Polis. This is a problem. And again, it's not just in Michigan. It's not just in Colorado. In Virginia, they are working to expand the state's red flag law in terms of, again, who can apply. That was one of the bills that passed the General Assembly this year. And as this law becomes more commonly evoked in the states that have adopted these extreme risk protection orders, it's going to become a bigger and bigger issue to not have access to this kind of data. As the Michigan carry attorney, Michigan open carry attorney, argued, whether or not you support these laws, you don't support these laws, you should know how they work. And if lawmakers are doing their best to ensure that that can't happen, well, we should be asking why, and we should be lobbying against them. This actually should be one area where, again, opponents and supporters of red flag laws should be able to come together. I don't like these red flag laws, but if they're going to be in place, I want transparency and I want accountability. Well, I like the fact that these red flag laws are in place, but we still need access to this information so we know how best to tool the statute so that it's most effective, right? You don't have to agree on the underlying premise of these things, but if they exist, both sides should be in favor of as much data and detail as possible. Again, not asking for the names and addresses of the people who were red flagged, but we should know the circumstances under which those petitions were filed, as well as the outcome, not just in terms of was the petition granted, but what actually happened to that individual in the months after that petition was in place. All right, let's change our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there. It's another case from Chicago. I actually had another story in mind, but I saw this headline and I thought, I mean, this is like twice in a week here that we've got an issue on the property of the Chicago Transit Authority. CTA robbery suspect freed on an ankle monitor, robbed somebody else 4 days later, according to prosecutors. The Supreme Court not meeting in conference tomorrow because it's Good Friday. So we won't have any orders from the Supreme Court coming out on Monday. Schoenthal versus Raul is the case dealing with Illinois' ban on concealed carry on public transportation and the CTA policy that prohibits that as well. It's been relisted a couple of times. Really don't know what's going on with it. I'm hopeful that the Supreme Court is going to grant cert because this is an issue. And it's not just an issue in Chicago, but it is a real issue in Chicago. Chicago Transit Authority property, pretty dangerous. Violent crime, pretty high. Trump administration actually threatened to yank federal funding because of the crime on CTA property. And Chicago has responded by surging police in some of these stations. And crime has gone down a little bit, but it's still far too common. And people don't have the ability to protect themselves because they are disarmed by law. So CWB Chicago reports that after prosecutors charged Emil Hobson with robbing a woman on the Chicago Transit Authority late last year, a judge ordered him to be kept in jail, saying that he was too dangerous to be trusted with an ankle monitor. But another judge reversed that decision and put Hobson on an ankle monitor, releasing him from jail. And CWB Chicago reports that court records show he immediately violated the law once again and robbed yet another victim. The 35-year-old Hobson was arrested November the 1st at the Roosevelt CTA station. Prosecutors said he walked up to an 18-year-old woman about 12:45 in the morning, told her to give him her purse or he would hurt her, and then walked off with a woman's bag. CTA employees called 911. Officers detained him nearby and recovered the woman's purse. There was video surveillance of the incident. Later that same day, Judge John Hawk ordered Hobson detained, citing what he called the randomness of the attack and Hobson's apparent, quote, willingness to prey on vulnerable people in public. By the way, everyone's vulnerable if they can't protect themselves. Hawk called him a clear threat to any person who might have an opportunity to rob, pointed to a prior robbery conviction on Hobson's record. And then 6 weeks later, Judge Terry Walton disagreed with that prior analysis and released Hobson on an ankle monitor. Very next day, CBB Chicago reports, the court's monitoring office noticed a major violation. He was supposed to be on 24-hour home confinement, but he did not show up at his home until 1:30 in the afternoon on December 19th, 4 days after Walton had released him. So he spent 4 days. He gets his ankle monitor, and then he spends 4 days violating the terms of his release. Records say that Hobson failed to charge the device and entered into sleep mode on December 22nd, at which point the office was unable to locate him and declared him absent without leave. It wasn't until December 23rd, though, that the monitoring office notified the judge that he had violated the terms of his release, and she issued a warrant the same day. About a month later, he was brought back before the judge, who again released him on electronic monitoring. What the what? Yeah. 4 days after that, prosecutors say Hobson robbed somebody else in a parking garage. January 31st, 6:30 in the morning, he allegedly approaches a 35-year-old, brandished what appeared to be the handle of a firearm or the, you know, butt of a gun, demanded the victim's gym bag and phone. After getting the phone's passcode, he fled. He was caught within minutes by Chicago police. They recovered the phone from a pocket. And then a different judge detained Hobson on the new robbery charge and for violating pretrial release in the earlier case. CWB Chicago says under new rules implemented by Cook County Chief Judge Charles Beach last month, All major electronic monitoring violations are now reported to judges within 24 hours. I don't know why the heck it took that long. The judge's office also announced that Cook County Sheriff's Office is expediting service of electronic monitoring-related warrants. Great. It's great. But it doesn't do any good if that major violation gets reported within 24 hours and then the judge says, yeah, but no big deal. I'm just going to keep on electronic monitoring. Right? And again, this is not an accident. This is all part of Illinois' Safety Act, the criminal justice reform that bends over backwards to treat those accused of a crime with respect and fairness. And again, you are innocent until proven guilty. But there are some circumstances when you can be considered a danger to the public and you can be held until trial. It is just very, very hard to do that now in Illinois. Just as it is very, very hard to protect yourself against violent criminals in Illinois, particularly on the property of the Chicago Transit Authority, which, again, is why the Supreme Court needs to grant cert in Schoenthal versus Rowell. Now, today's armed citizen story from Tallahassee, Florida, a man shot after an alleged home invasion in the city. Don't have a ton of information. This actually happened back in February, but the Leon County Sheriff's Office charged a suspect this week with a residential robbery. 42-year-old Scott Scruggs faces felony counts of burglary of a structure while armed, as well as aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. It was just before 10 p.m. on February the 6th when deputies from the Leon County Sheriff's Office responded to reports of shot fired. They got to the home. They discovered a man suffering from a gunshot wound. It actually was Scruggs, as it turns out. Detectives determined that Scruggs had broken into the home, would not leave, even after the homeowner told him to do so. Scruggs then threatened to shoot the homeowner, but the homeowner fired a round from his handgun, hitting Scruggs. No other people inside the home were injured. Scruggs was taken to a local hospital. At the time, he was in critical condition, so maybe now he's recovered to the point that he can go to court on these charges. But again, the Leon County Sheriff's Office charging Scott Scruggs, the armed citizen who defended himself against Scruggs, not facing any charges at all. And finally today, our good deed of the day. This one, I gotta say, this is a sad story. But, you know, I run across these stories on occasion. One of the searches that I'll do when I'm trying to find these stories, I'll just search Good Samaritan. And it is not uncommon for me to find stories of Good Samaritans who tried to do the right thing and ended up harmed because of it, right? They pull over to the side of the road, they help somebody with a flat tire, and they get robbed. Or they get struck by a passing car. Somebody comes to the aid of somebody who's being victimized and they get stabbed or beaten up or shot. And I don't really know what to do with those stories. I mean, these are people, again, who are trying to do the right thing. It just doesn't work out well for them. And I just came across this heartbreaking story today from San Antonio. The headline, a roving Good Samaritan. Friends speak lovingly of murdered Eastside man whose body was found burning. Somebody set this 84-year-old man, Manuel Manny Mendez Jr., on fire. They found his body Saturday morning. Someone driving by reported they thought was a grass fire. And firefighters went out. They were, you know, putting out the flames. And then they discovered a body in the middle of the charred grass. They called in homicide investigators. They found out that Mendez's body had its hands bound, been wrapped in a jacket and a shower curtain. It's an 84-year-old man. Again, it's just absolutely horrific. KSAT says Melvin Fechner fought back tears Wednesday morning as he spoke about Mendez, who he called Manny. He said the Eastside senior had worked tirelessly in the community for years, often loaning his time to the charity that Fechner and his family run called His Bridge Builders. Fechner said he made a big difference in a lot of people's lives, always being with God's people, doing the work of God, to love God and to love his neighbors. He said he had witnessed Mendez bending over backwards, trying to fill whatever needs people may have had, from providing food and clothing to getting the medical help and housing. So he was just looking out for people to befriend and see how he could help them out. And, you know, so I do want to honor Manuel Mendez Jr., who sounds like he was an amazing man. But I think this is also a reminder that even for those who try to make the world a better place, they should understand that the world needs to be a better place, right? And there are people out there who don't care about the goodness in your heart. They don't care about the kindness you're showing to others. They may actually see that as weakness. And, you know, I think that you should walk through life with love in your heart. But I don't think that negates the need to walk with a gun on your hip, or if you prefer appendix carry or ankle carry, whatever. Love your neighbor. Help out strangers when you can. But protect yourself while you're doing so. Because as much as you might be wanting to help people, there are others in this world who are intent on hurting people. And you may very well become a victim of one of these monsters. So I hope that they catch Manuel Mendez's killer, or killers. I hope that they are prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. I hope they never spend another day in freedom. Again, what happened to this 84-year-old man is absolutely horrific and monstrous. But I want everybody who wants to do what Manuel Mendez was doing for his community, I want them to be able to protect themselves. And I hope that they will avail themselves of their right to carry. So, again, I can't say in the right place at the right time, trying to do will and able to do the right thing. I mean, that is, it sounds like, how Manuel Mendez lived his life. I just hope that, again, prosecutors are able to bring his killers to justice. And on that sad note, that's going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. I do want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again on Monday. We're going to be talking one last time about this Bridging the Divide program. You know, we had David Yamane on a couple weeks ago. I've written about this program a couple of times at Bearing Arms, where you know, gun control advocates got together with the gun owners and some Second Amendment advocates, and the idea was, what can we come up with that the red states would agree to that will, you know, save lives, and, you know, we'll have some trade-offs here. I don't think the trade-offs really were worth it. I kind of take issue, not just kind of, I do take issue with the premise of, you know, what kind of gun controls can we get red states to accept. But we're going to be talking with the architect of this program, Dr. Michael Siegel. Reached out to me a couple weeks ago, and we've been talking, and I thought, you know, we had David on, and I really appreciate David spending some time with us. I love what David does in terms of Second Amendment advocacy and reminding non-gun owners on the left that gun ownership is normal. And I shared my criticisms with David, and David was very gracious in acknowledging those. But, you know, David was invited to participate in this program. He didn't come up with it. So when I had the opportunity to say, well, yeah, let's do a sit down with Dr. Siegel, and I can talk to him directly about my issues here, I thought it'd be worthwhile to extend that invitation. And he was gracious enough to accept. So we're going to be talking with Dr. Michael Siegel on Monday about this Bridging the Divide program. Is there a way to make this work so that gun owners like me might be more inclined to listen? I've got a couple of suggestions. We'll see if Dr. Siegel's willing to to take any of them under advisement. But anyway, that's coming up on Monday's Bearing Arms Cam and Company. Be sure to check out the website today, tomorrow, throughout the weekend. It is Easter weekend, so posting will be maybe a little bit lighter than normal, but we are going to be covering all of the big Second Amendment stories from across the nation. And if anything breaks over the weekend, we will provide full coverage of that for you as well. If you are celebrating Easter this weekend, I wish you a very happy Easter. I wish you a good Passover if you are celebrating that as well. And again, I hope that you have a great weekend, whatever is in store for you. Looking forward to seeing you back here again on Monday. Until then, be well. Be safe.